And first, before we say anything about the BBC's own transmissions in 20 languages, we should like to paint for you a picture of the flood of enemy propaganda. It is one of the BBC's tasks to erect a dam of truth against this never-ceasing torrent of lies and rumors. Before that can be done, it must know precisely what they are and where they come from. So, now, in the ear of Britain, you will hear how the BBC keeps constant watch upon the propaganda and news broadcast by enemy countries. But although you will hear how every day 250 foreign bulletins of about 500,000 words, eight times the length of an average-sized novel, are noted down, recorded, sifted, summarized, analyzed, it is, after all, only a large-scale picture of something that's happening in a small way in the home of many British listeners.
Angel, Daddy, and switch it off?
With pleasure, my dear.
Ooh, I couldn't bear it. It's quite a good tune, but seven times in one day really is too often.
Oh, I don't know. It's very nice as a background if you keep it turned down.
Well, half a tick. I'll see if I can get any foreign stations. There's always a bulletin in English somewhere on the dial.
Still, dear, we had our own news at 9 o'clock.
Well, I like to hear what the foreigners are saying.
Oh, very well. Now, so long as you don't switch on that awful German.
Oh, but
I will not have his voice in my house, at least not so long as I'm in it.
Come, come. We won't get rid of him simply by hiding our heads in the sand.
The government ought to make it a punishable offence to listen to him.
My dear, so far as I understand it, one of the reasons why we're fighting this war is so that we can, as it were, continue to tune in where we like.
That's all very well.
Oh,
I know.
I can't go into that all over again.
Anyway, I'm only trying to get that rather nice American who's usually on about now. Shortwaves don't sound too good tonight.
They sound horrible.
I prefer that Frenchman. You can get him on the long and medium both, I think.
Well, it's past his time.
Monsieur Molotov said it was not merely Finnish troops that the Soviet troops encountered, but the combined forces of the imperialists of a number of countries aimed at kindling war against the Soviet Union at all costs.
Moscow.
I can't understand how you can tell without hearing the announcement.
Well, my dear, there was a faint tinge of Bolshevist propaganda.
We Germans who are imperialists, the minister stressed, but Britain, who has built up her power by brute force.
William?
Sorry, Mother. I wonder what's the effect of it all. This jet of propaganda that's being sprayed on us night and day.
Well, surely most of it's too absurd for anyone to believe.
I wonder.
Some people are such asses, they believe everything they hear on the air, just as they used to say it must be true because it's in the papers.
Mrs. Jones was quite upset this morning because she just heard from Zazen that she was starving. But then she'd believe anything.
The BBC ought simply to jam all foreign broadcasts.
But don't you think that if you did that, you'd simply exaggerate that importance? Still, I admit I like to think someone's keeping a pretty close eye on foreign broadcasting.
Yes, whose job is it to keep an eye on foreign broadcasting?
Yes, whose job is it? I wonder.
Whose job is it? I'd like to know whose job it is.
For the love of Mike, come in. Shut that door.
Sorry, old man. The light's blind a bit for a second. Oh, it's dark tonight and cold.
And the wind as you get to the top.
Hello, what's happened to you?
Looks as if he'd fallen over Jack Warner's bike.
A real fuel. Oh, it's nothing. Battery went dead on me at the foot. I had to come up the blessed hill by instinct, and it faltered a bit when I got to the place where the path turned off left. Before I knew, I was punching about in the bushes.
I said, do you mind putting up the stove, my boy? Temperature must have dropped 10 degrees just now.
There you are. Good evening, Miss Jones. What do they want tonight?
Oh, the usual bunch. Deutschlander, 21 and 23 o'clock. Hamburg in English, 21:15 and 0:15. Leipzig in French, 21:15. Vienna in Romanian, 21:14. Munich in Italian, 23:15. I've pinned the list up here.
Let's have a look. Rome in English, 19:00. Rome in Italian, 19:15. Radio Vatican in English for North America, 0230. Radio Vatican in German for Germany. Radio Paris, Strasbourg, Lyons. Moscow in English, German and Russian. Hilversum. As you said, the same old bunch. When are they going to give us something new?
Standing by here for the Deutschland said in German. Do they want it recorded as well?
Yes, they're going to listen just now, but they want the record as a standby. May I just check on that transmission?
Okay, here's some phones.
Vom Sinn und Lebensnotwendigkeit des Kampfes unseres Volkes sprach der Führer von den Pflichten und Aufgaben des Offiziers in der nationalsozialistischen Wehrmacht.
So, night after night, the work of picking up these foreign stations goes on. There are moments of excitement.
Her engines are turning over. I can see a dense cloud of smoke coming from her funnel. It looks to me like the grass space getting on the way and going out to meet whatever's coming for it.
Yes, there are moments of excitement. And any night, any second, these foreign transmissions may carry the first hint of staggering news. But mostly the work is humdrum. The job of the engineers is to secure good reception and to pass on the bulletins in as clear a condition as possible to the translators listening on headphones at the foot of the hill.
I hope I'm not hurrying you, but is the Deutschlandsend translation ready?
Just finished. Wait a moment, please, while I check it against the record.
Von Churchill kann man nichts anderes als Lügen und Verleumdungen erwarten.
Only lies, distortions can be expected from Churchill's impertinent threats against the new rule.
Die Bemerkungen, die Churchill an die Adresse der Sowjetunion richtete, werden in der Moskauer Presse mit gebührender Ironie abgefertigt. Große Aufmerksamkeit schenkt man jedoch den Drohungen Churchills gegen die neutralen Staaten. Das umso mehr, als diese Äußerungen den Einfluss noch.
He just finished.
Finish what?
At the Deutschland Center translation.
Oh, yes, let me see. Do you mind standing by a moment, please? A half minute. They need to send this paragraph complete. Just a repetition of the item in the earlier bulletin. This bit's new, though. Will you hand it into the teleprinter girl? Tell him I want them to take precedence over those Spanish bulletins I've just had.
I'll do that. You don't want it to go before the finish, do you?
No, I want them to have all the finish, both Lahti and Moscow.
Oh, righto. I'll get that done.
So the contents of the 250 foreign news bulletins, already summarized to a certain extent, are pushed on to London, where they come off the teleprinting machines in neatly typed sheets. But some items are of too urgent a nature to wait upon the delays of print.
Hello, monitoring service here. German radio reports new minefield in following
position. Hello, Matalda reports German bomber down on Norwegian
coast. Monitoring service here. Zaysen for North America, broadcasting report.
Hello, monitoring service here.
Hello, monitoring service here.
Hello, monitoring service here. Hello, monitoring service here.
While the more urgent points are being disposed of by telephone, sub-editors are hard at work condensing the bulletins still further, reducing these 8 average-size novels to the length of a third of one. They are laboring to produce on time.
The Daily Digest of Foreign Bulletins, confidential, covering the period of 24 hours ending at 7 a.m.
Part 1, ready at noon. German transmissions and daily notes, that is to say, first, broadcast by Germany in German and for Germans. Second, broadcast by Germany in English and other languages to the rest of the world. Third, the rebel broadcast of the Free German Station.
Part 2, ready at 3 p.m. All transmissions other than German, comprising bulletins in 26 of the languages spoken in the 5 continents of the world.
So ends the first part of our story. The story of how the Daily Digest is prepared. The uses of information and counter-propaganda to which it is put cannot yet be told. Leaving it in its place as one stone in the vast battlement of national security, let us return to that family of devoted listeners, Father, Mother, Bill, and Mary.
Today.
Yes, I think you might spare us.
Well, I was only trying to get that American commentator for you.
I wish you'd stick to one thing, whatever it is. I can't bear when you go fiddling with those knobs and changing about from station to station without stopping to listen to anything. But don't bother about me. I'm going off to get the cocoa.
Well, let me do it.
No, no. There are times when it's a pleasure to get into the kitchen.
Funny. Mother gets quite angry if I dare to tune in anything outside the home service. I say, while she's out of the room, let's see if Lord Haw-Haw's still on the air. You don't hear so much about him nowadays.
Very well, but do switch it off before she appears again. We don't want to upset her.
Trust little William. Let's see.
Britain and France wanted the war and repulsed the Führer's offers of peace with the threat to annihilate the Führer and Germany. But now they will get the war which they desired.
Quick,
to its bitter end.
With the cocoa. William? What was that I heard?
Well, don't you know the fat stock prices when you hear them, darling?
There have been no fat stock prices since the good old days. Here's your cocoa.
Thank you.
I can't think why you listen to that dreadful person.
Well, it's good entertainment. Well, once in a while. As good as music hall.
Well, I'm like Mother. He makes me furious.
It's funny. I've noticed he generally makes women very angry. But don't run away with the idea, my dear, that we turn him on for that reason.
More sugar.
Well, why do you listen, then?
Well, a man has a different outlook from a woman. He's interested to see what sort of a performance the other side's putting up. He likes to watch out for the mistakes. And at the same time, he likes to give credit where the chap's been a bit cleverer than usual.
Well, I must say, I can't understand it. I can't see why people should want to hear their country abused.
Personally, I don't think these foreign propaganda broadcasts make a ha'porth of difference.
I don't agree. I think they're terribly serious.
Well, I'm inclined to think Mother's right. They're terribly serious.
I still don't think they make a ha'porth of difference. Not a ha'porth of difference.
They're terribly serious.
They don't make a ha'porth of difference. They're terribly serious. There must be few of you who haven't heard arguments on just those lines by our own firesides. How seriously ought we to take the danger of enemy broadcasts? Well, it's a difficult question, and perhaps the answer would run something like this. It shouldn't be taken so seriously as some alarmists are inclined to do, and at the same time, it isn't wise to dismiss German broadcasting as just another variety entertainment. And the reason why it shouldn't be lightly dismissed is this.
Hitler has proved himself in the past to be a master propagandist. And those of us whose job it is to study the German broadcast day after day can see quite clearly that every broadcast forms part of a large-scale plan. If you listen in only occasionally or in an uncritical way, you may find a good deal that's convincing in these broadcasts. But the moment you've got a glimpse of that larger plan, German propaganda has no more puzzles for you. And the plan is so clear-cut that one can reconstruct, without, I feel, being very unjust to Dr. Goebbels, a meeting which, in some form or other, must have taken place in the propaganda ministry at Berlin about the time of the outbreak of war.
Then, over to the propaganda ministry in Berlin to hear how anti-British war propaganda was planned.
Angriff.
Here.
Völkischer Beobachter.
Here.
Frankfurter Zeitung.
Here.
So much for newspapers. Now for radio. Is the Deutsche Rundfunk here?
Here.
You have the director of broadcasting to England with you?
Yes. Yes, I am in charge of broadcasting to England.
Good. His Excellency the Reichsminister asked me specially to check that you'd arrive.
Dr. Goebbels is taking the meeting himself today.
His Excellency attaches the greatest importance to it. Quiet. He's coming.
Heil Hitler.
Heil Hitler.
Heil Hitler.
Today, you meet to receive instructions on the subject of anti-British propaganda. I need not remind you of the all-importance of this subject. The Führer himself has laid it down that the war of 1914 was lost because of the excellence of the propaganda of the Entente powers and the failure of our own. We Germans do not twice commit the same blunder. Propaganda must be regarded as a field of warfare. And in this field, attack is emphatically the best means of defense. If it is to succeed, German propaganda must set itself a single aim, which must be nothing less than the disintegration of public opinion in Great Britain. By that, I mean that in the minds of the British, confidence in the justice of their cause and the honesty of their leaders must be broken down until their war effort collapses through indecision, lack of will, or revolution. How is that aim to be achieved? In an historic chapter of his great work, the Führer has drawn an illuminating comparison between political propaganda and commercial advertising. In advertising, the object is to teach the masses the habit of buying a certain product. The aim of our propaganda to England must be to implant a certain idea, a certain picture in the minds of the enemy. That picture, which we must project night and day, is of the British Empire in a state of rottenness and decay. By this picture, we must replace in the minds of the English the traditional views which they hold of themselves.
It will be difficult.
But not impossible. Every item of news, every comment, every talk which you use must add a stroke to the painting of this picture. You will show that the people of England are misled by corrupt and irresponsible leaders. You will show how a small wealthy class leaves the masses to misery and exploitation. You will show that the British Empire was built on brutality and rapacity and is now as decadent as the mother country. You will hold up an England hated by the world for her selfishness and ruthlessness. Germany, on the other hand, is to be depicted as a fresh, young power striving to free herself, the world, and even the British people from the tyrannous fetters of the British ruling class. If this picture is accepted, even for a moment, by the British people, then the German aim is achieved.
Don't forget, then, that the German broadcaster's solicitude for the downtrodden British is not purely for the good of their health. Propaganda is warfare. And bear in mind, too, the Führer's other precept, that you can best distract attention from your own weaknesses by pinning them on someone else. Thus, if you want to commit an act of aggression against, let us say, Czechoslovakia, you declare...
Germany will no longer tolerate the murderous aggression of the Czechs.
Applied to Great Britain, the technique remains the same. So, when a British listener hears that...
The people of England are misled by corrupt and irresponsible leaders.
He is not intended to reflect that the charge comes from a Germany misled by Hitler, Goering, Goebbels, and Ribbentrop. When he hears that...
A small, wealthy class leaves the masses to misery and exploitation.
He is not intended to recall the Mercedes cars, castles in Bavaria, and bank balances in foreign capitals, which distinguish the ruling Nazi clique from their terrorized and impoverished fellow countrymen. In the same way, when the British listener learns that...
The British Empire was built on brutality and rapacity.
It would be wrong of him call to mind the gentle conquerors of Czechoslovakia and Poland. But bearing in mind that the object of Nazi propaganda is to instill into the British listener a conception of Britain old, feeble, corrupt, and cruel, let us pay a further visit to the propaganda ministry in Berlin to see in a little fuller detail how the campaign against Britain is planned.
It is of the utmost importance that we ourselves should select and keep clearly in mind the individual types from which German propaganda can expect the best results. And here, do not imagine that I am referring to those English men and women who before the war paraded their sympathies with National Socialism. These simpletons we can very well afford to dismiss. In broadcasting to England, the following three types must be kept constantly in mind. First, the proletarian dweller in the slums. Second, the middle-class businessman. And third, the post-war intellectual. In each of these categories, the chances are greatest of discovering malcontents who can be played upon by propaganda. Now, take first the proletarian. He is to be approached on the line of social revolution. Statistics unfavorable to capitalistic society are to be contrasted with the achievements of the new Germany. The ideal, however, must not be that of the Second or Third International, but of National Socialism. While the appeal for socialism is to be emotional and directed not only to the impulsive type, but also to those with moral and religious problems, the arguments directed towards the middle classes with settled incomes and small vested interests are to be different. They are to be based upon figures, increases in the cost of living, in the income tax. Above all, the bad effect of war on British trade is to be driven home. Attack them in the only place they're sensitive. The pocket. And lastly, the intellectual. He is to be attacked in the language of the English liberal and socialist press. With him, the colonial problem, the failure of the League of Nations, the Treaty of Versailles, the revival of imperialism, self-government for India, will all be profitable topics. Play on the moral sense of the British.
Propaganda is warfare, said the Führer. And we should do ill to forget that the troop concentrations, U-boat attacks, and reconnaissance flights of German naval and military strategy have their counterpart in the war of the ether. And just as an advertising campaign has its slogans, to be repeated time after time until the public really believes them, so in propaganda, certain phrases have to be repeated time after time until the listener begins to regard the idea underlying them as proven beyond doubt.
The Jewish capitalist domination of the city of London.
The the oppression of British working class,
the failure of British export trade.
The British feed convicts and starve children.
Britain goes short of food.
The war was forced upon Germany by Britain.
The British have lost command of the seas.
But now, for one last visit to the propaganda ministry in Berlin.
Finally, it is, I think, clearly understood by all present here that the democratic sources of news enjoy a prestige which is not, unfortunately, accorded to those of the Reich, and which must at all costs be destroyed. As you are all aware, the Führer has decreed that henceforth listening to foreign radio will be a crime to be visited with the most severe penalties. In spite of this, it is necessary for us to attack by every means in our power the authenticity of Allied news. Here, the freedom of the British press can be of great service to us. It is rarely that their accounts of any event do not show discrepancies which, with skill, we can turn to our profit. Their freedom to criticize will also supply us with invaluable ammunition. The reliability of British news, then, is to be assailed with every available weapon, and particularly with the weapons of contempt and ridicule.
Dr. Goebbels has laid it down that attack is the best means of defense. Therefore, it's not exactly discouraging to the British cause to discover that the honesty of British news has German propaganda constantly on the defensive. And here again, you'll find the problem set out wherever a family of listeners argues round the fire.
William, switch off that radio or I'll go straight up to bed.
Sorry, Mother. I was just trying to get
there. We've had enough chopping and changing for one night. I'm sick and tired of hearing all those lies about our country.
Well, darling, as long as we don't believe them, there's no need to worry.
Well, I suppose the Germans believe them. They don't get a chance to do anything else.
Well, you'd think the poor fish would be bound to smell a rat now and again.
I don't know. German radio tells the same tale all the time. And as what it's telling is mainly a work of fiction, all it's got to do is to stick to the rules and be consistent.
Well, that's all very well, Dad, but there's a Scotsman in our office who has a saying, or I think it's a quotation from Burns, or a Scots proverb or something. Facts are chills the winner ding. I think it means that facts are chaps you can't knock down.
I like that. What did you say it was?
Facts are chills that winner ding.
Facts are chills that winner ding.
Yes, very good. Facts are chills that winner ding.
Facts are chills that winner ding. The monitoring service has proved, time after time, that Dr. Goebbels would have benefited by a sound appreciation of these words. For never did facts more obstinately prove themselves to be unbeatable than in the case of a certain German pocket battleship called the Admiral Graf von Spee. It was on December the 13th, 1939, at 17 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time, that the voice of an American announcer flung across the Atlantic the first hints of an action off the estuary of the Plate River.
From Buenos Aires comes the rumor that British naval authorities are probing a report that their light cruiser, the Achilles, was sunk by the Admiral Scheer. The story going the rounds in the Argentine capital is that the noise of a battle was heard off the east coast of Uruguay, on the other side of the River Plate. But the officers of a Japanese steamer, which docked after passing through the area of the supposed combat, said they had heard and seen absolutely nothing of a naval engagement.
At 11:30 next morning came the German official communique.
The Admiral Graf Spee, one of the naval units operating in Atlantic waters since the beginning of the war, attacked the convoy route from the River Plate to European waters and sank the British steamers Tyrora of 7,983 tons and Streams Hall of 3,895 tons. On this occasion, the battleship came into fighting contact with the heavy cruiser Exeter and the light cruisers Ajax and Achilles, and succeeded in doing heavy damage to the enemy forces, in spite of their numerical superiority. Exeter, after having sustained severe hits, had to withdraw from the battle. One of the light cruisers was also severely damaged. On the other hand, Admiral Graf Spee also sustained some hits and is now in port at Montevideo, Uruguay.
That was only a beginning. The more vivid imagination of Dr. Goebbels and his friends had not yet got to work. Deutschlandsender, in German, for Germany, December the 19th, 1 p.m.
Salvos from the Grass Bay forced Exeter to withdraw. Ajax and Achilles also fled after being heavily hit. And the battle ended in victory for the Grass Bay.
At that time, an important embroidery made its appearance.
It is known that in breach of international law, the English fired poison gas shells and used mustard gas. But among the wounded are victims of gas poisoning.
The story continued to grow. 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
The German naval victory has caused a sensation in the whole of America. And in Montevideo, until late last night, tens of thousands of people were in the streets expressing general admiration of the Graf Spee's heroic fight.
The tale as it was being told by American broadcasters was, it is true, slightly different.
International News Service reports that the German minister at Montevideo is negotiating with Uruguayan officials for the internment of the German vessel for the duration. What exactly the purpose of mustard gas could be in warfare designed to disable or sink the opponent doesn't seem to be quite clear to anyone.
In spite of everything, Hans Fritzsche, in his daily propaganda talk to Germany, went even further.
So, three English cruisers, which far exceeded the German battleship in speed, were destroyed by the Graf Spee.
A similar tale was being told in broadcasts to this country.
Graf Spee went into Montevideo to reprovision, as the illegal use of gas shells had rendered some provisions unsuitable for consumption. Thousands of spectators were able to see for themselves that there were no traces of the engagement on the victorious German battleship.
Throughout the evening, the story is repeated in every length. Next day, however, the rest of the world was no longer interested in arguing to whom the victory had fallen. There was one topic of speculation.
It was learned tonight that the Graf Spee had been given a time limit of 72 hours to carry out repairs and put to sea.
It is believed the Graf Spee will be asked to put to sea immediately repairs are complete, although the 72-hour limit may not have expired.
It is reported that Montevideo trade unionists have refused to carry out repairs on the Graf Spee.
Berlin authorities announced that Uruguay has refused to grant more than 24 hours stay in Montevideo.
In Berlin, an American commentator was putting his finger on disagreement between the German high command and the propaganda ministry over the use of poison gas.
Strangely, the assertion that mustard gas shells were used by Britain in the engagement has been silenced. When I questioned semi-official sources in Berlin on the matter, I was told that a full statement was a matter of time. Official information says nothing of mustard gas, and the report of the German high command ignores the claim completely.
Simultaneously, a note of hesitancy could be discerned in the Goebbels propaganda.
The Graf Spee fought against overwhelming odds. Everyone in Montevideo could convince themselves of the Graf Spee's undamaged condition after a fight against threefold odds.
Upon which France promptly commented,
even the German public can hardly be expected to believe that the British Navy, which yesterday they were told was puerile, has become a mighty force overnight.
An American commentator in Berlin observed,
I mentioned last night that the German papers were keeping mum about guns in this battle. But today, the 12-hour Blatt breaks silence to say that it was a case of 12 German guns against 22 English guns. That they were 11-inch guns against 8 and 6-inch is not emphasized.
Next day, as the world waited, Germany still tried to keep up the pose.
The Rio de la Plata battle has caused a great loss of prestige for Britain throughout South America and is likely to have repercussions on her commercial relations.
But meantime, American radio was telling the world what the captain of the Graf Spee himself had said.
Captain Lansdorff said that a daring feat of British seamanship forced him into a running fight dangerously near the shore. He was unable to run out for an open fight because of lack of fuel, and he was perilously near to dangerous shallows. The cruisers Ajax and Achilles took incredible risks, he said, to get within range and score effective hits.
As the Graf Spee's time limit expired, a desperate campaign of face-saving began in Germany.
The use of gas shells is confirmed by a cable from Dr. Meyerhoff to a British newspaper.
Graf Spee heavily damaged two of the British vessels and completely put out of action the third.
The Graf Spee had to face a much stronger enemy.
For months past, the Graf Spee has raided enemy shipping in all seven seas and sunk approximately 60,000 tons.
Anything, in fact, to distract the minds of listeners from the inevitable conclusion that the only victory in which the Graf Spee had taken part was a British one. And just to make things awkward for Dr. Goebbels...
It is reported that the battle cruiser Renown and the aircraft carrier Ark Royal, both of which the German radio claimed had been sunk, are on their way to Montevideo and have put into Rio de Janeiro for refueling.
But by this time, no one, perhaps not even Germans, had time to listen to German excuses. All over the world, receiving sets were tuned to American shortwave transmissions.
If the Spey moves along by the deadline hour tonight, she faces what seems to be certain destruction.
Her engines are turning over slowly.
Naval experts say her commander is determined to put to sea, and the Uruguayan fleet are clearing the docks in the vicinity of the Grasse Pays.
Clouds of smoke are coming from the funnels of the Grasse Pays. The battleship's ready to leave at any moment.
She's moving. She's definitely moving off, away from the quayside and down the river. It looks like she's getting underway and going out to take what's coming to her.
She's turning out to sea.
Out there, the British battleships are waiting.
The Grasse Pays has just been blown up and sunk by her crew.
Suddenly, spectators saw a column of smoke on deck and then flames. Then an enormous explosion shook the whole of Montevideo, smashing windows everywhere. A pillar of flame rose from the doomed vessel, succeeded by more explosions. The Grasse Pays, which cost 70 million Reichsmarks, was blazing like some fantastic bonfire.
From Berlin came a ball communique.
As the Uruguayan government has refused permission for the Grasse Pays to remain in harbor for the time necessary to carry out full repairs, the Führer and Supreme Commander of the German Navy has ordered the captain of the Grasse Pays to scuttle his ship. And this has been carried out.
From New York, the comments.
However much Germans may try to show that this event is a moral victory, the German people will not be blinded to the fact of British and French superiority. It is undeniably a great victory.
Next day, from Berlin, there ascended a howl of rage.
The British hounds, who had come in packs to this spot, should hold down their flags, as in spite of all, the Grasse Pays has deprived them of the glory.
She was not intended to attack warships in the first place.
She was destined to be a raider.
She worthily defended the honor of the admiral whose name she bore.
Chamberlain has pronounced only calumnies and curses against the German sailors. He calls them pirates and bandits and shows himself a revengeful old man. He is clearly a bad sport and has nothing but words of hate.
But Dr. Goebbels felt that this was a negative line for really imaginative propaganda to take. So, that evening, from Deutschlandsender...
Great German air success this afternoon, when British aeroplanes were shot down in an attack on the North Sea coast.
But an American commentator speaking to America from Berlin thought...
When the Grasse Pays went down in smoke, she blew up the hopes of the little man in Germany, who had been led to believe that whatever happened, the Grasse Pays would make a run for it. The average German is perplexed by today's reports, as all stories of the battle had insisted that she was only slightly damaged.
As the dismay of the German listener grew, so did the reports of the air battle over the North Sea.
It is now confirmed that more British machines were shot down.
Upon which an American broadcaster in Berlin made this cynical comment.
It is somewhat unusual for us to hear of a battle the same day that happens. I hear the English have a different version, but that is not at all unusual. All we can do in Berlin is to report the war as it appears from here and hope you will be able to form some sort of conclusion.
To South America, to Asia and the Far East, to Holland, to the Arabs and to the French, but not in English. Dr. Goebbels then declared,
shameful scenes occurred at the funeral of members of the Grasse Pays crew when British sailors from ships in Montevideo Harbor spat on the coffins of German heroes and... during the funeral ovation over the graves. The German sailors had hardly been buried when the English sailors threw a dead dog into the grave.
While to Great Britain, he was declaring...
The British wireless goes so far as to assert that we tried to make propaganda beside the open graves of dead sailors with allegations about a dead dog. No, no, gentlemen. The German people are a people of soldiers.
And all the time... a last secret was being kept from the German listener. Not until many hours after it was known to the rest of the world did he learn that...
The high command of the German Navy announces that Captain Lansdorff did not wish to survive his ship. After he had brought into safety the crew entrusted to his care, he regarded his task as completed and followed his ship.
So ended the story of the Graf Spee. A struggle between the truth and a legion of mendacities, which the members of the monitoring service were able to study blow by blow. In their records, it figures as the most striking example of a German lie ruthlessly exposed by the events themselves. But many of the lies are not so exposed. Many of the fictions of the German propaganda ministry must go unchecked. Many are less blatant and more skillful. At the moment, they may be bewildering, and because founded on half-truths, difficult to dismiss. Behind them is the Führer's view of the intelligence of the ordinary man and woman, set down for all time in Mein Kampf.
The receptive powers of the masses are very restricted, and their understanding is feeble. On the other hand, they quickly forget. The broad masses of the people are not composed of persons who are able to form reasoned judgments, but a vacillating crowd of human children who are constantly wavering between one idea and another.
That is the challenge which the free British listener, tuning in to hostile broadcasts, must be prepared to meet.
You've been listening to The Ear of Britain, the story of the BBC's monitoring service in a series of three programs, War in the Ether. Leo Ginn told the story. The family of listeners were Betty Estelle, Gladys Young, Ivor Barnard and Charles Mason. Dr. Goebbels was played by Alan Wheatley. The American announcers were Sidney Keith, Peter Madden and David Miller. The German announcers were Laban Brown, Howard Marion Crawford, Valentine Dial and Geoffrey Winkert. The part of the secretary was played by Alice Powell. The last section of the program was based on the monitoring service reports of various broadcasts. The Ear of Britain was written and produced by Robert Kemp.